Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Afte. The program is a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. We are facing enemies, both foreign and domestic, of course. We chronicle that here every single day. Some are more dangerous than others. Among the most dangerous, I would argue, are the ones that are attacking Western civilization. Not just individual countries, even our own, but trying to take down the Judeo-Christian civilization specifically. Very much in the crosshairs at the moment, of course, is our friend and ally, the State of Israel. I believe what is afoot now is no longer a question of whether the United States will interfere with Israel's victory over a group our own government calls an international terrorist group. It's even said, I believe on occasion, that it should be destroyed. But rather, whether Israel is going to be compelled to surrender to Hamas. And that is the practical effect, my friends, I believe, of the idea of making a ceasefire. It'll be an open-ended sort of ceasefire. A ceasefire that leaves Hamas intact, that prevents it from being destroyed. Rooted out and destroyed, in Rafah specifically, to say nothing of Israel's other enemies, all of whom are waiting expectantly for precisely that outcome, because it's being telegraphed right and left by the Biden administration and other world leaders. Our purpose here at Securing America is to explain why that is totally unacceptable to any American who seeks to assure the survival, well, yes, of Western civilization, Judeo-Christian civilization, but also our piece of it. And I think it's important to note, as is often pointed out by Donald Trump, the people coming after him, and there are a lot of them, are only doing so because he's in the way of their getting at us. I believe Benjamin Netanyahu is similarly standing in the way of not only the people who seek, obviously, his destruction, but also that of the Jewish state, but more to the point, Western civilization, including the United States of America. To talk about all of this and much more, we are pleased to welcome back, after a long hiatus due to the observance of the high holy days of Passover, is our friend Pastor, he could pass for a pastor. He does shoulder to shoulder with a pastor, as a matter of fact, but he is a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi based in Israel now, our friend Pesach Walicki. Welcome back, Rabbi. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Always an honor to be with you and with your audience, with your esteemed audience.
I could go on and on about your credentials, but I don't want to take the time to do it because we've got so much to talk about. Our esteemed audience needs to hear some ground truth from you about what the Biden administration is doing in our name to not just Bibi Netanyahu, but the State of Israel. And I want to hit especially something that's developed since you and I last talked, and that is what I call the global governance gambit, a line of attack that is indirect, but potentially devastating to the Jewish state, and frankly, creating precedents that would be devastating for us as well. Talk with us about that the International Criminal Court dimension of this, for starters, sir, if you would.
So the International Criminal Court is set to announce war crimes charges against Israeli officials in the coming days. And we have this, you know, this kind of game that they play. We know the way the apparatus works, where the U.S. government is officially saying that they're not in favor of the International Criminal Court's charges against Israeli officials, but at the same time, we have a memo that was leaked. State Department officials from three different agencies within the State Department, the National Security Memorandum that they included, that they said here that they are not sure that they trust Israel's assurances that they are not committing war crimes. This joint submission from the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration, and the Bureau of Global Criminal Justice and International Organization Affairs raised, quote, serious concern over non-compliance with international humanitarian law. Now, this was leaked just 2 days ago, right in the midst of this whole discussion going on the international stage about whether the International Criminal Court is going to charge Israeli officials. So you have this dance going on where the Biden administration can say, oh, no, 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 we have no part of that. But at the same time, they're getting this internal pressure from their own appointees, from the State Department officials who are saying that they kind of agree with the International Criminal Court, saying that the Israelis have committed war crimes. Let's also point out that the International Criminal Court, their star witnesses that they interview to make the determinations about whether or not Israel was committing war crimes, were employees of the Shifa Hospital and the other hospitals that are used as terrorist bases in the Gaza Strip. The whole thing is a rigged system, obviously. And what you see, look, this is, Frank, you talk about this global governance issue all the time. This is the Biden administration, you know, talking out of both sides of their mouth, but really surrendering authority to the International Criminal Court.
Let me just make one further point on this, and I hope you have seen our friend and colleague's Carolyn Glick's excellent video on this ICC issue. It's available at carolynglick.com. David Wormser and I talked about it yesterday.
Must watch.
You know, one of the things that she says, and this has been reported, I know, not just by her, but by people inside the Israeli press who have been in touch, we're told, with staff of the International Criminal Court. They have been told that the United States government has actually green-lighted these indictments. And there's some talk, I guess, that they're also going to indict Hamas operatives. But this suggests, again, that whatever the State Department games are, the Biden administration is on the QT, perhaps, telling the ICC to go for it. And Pesek, I just want to introduce this thought, because I know it's somewhat new to you. But it's the subject of my Secure Freedom Minute for today. And my friends, if you are not subscribing to that minute every day, you're missing just 1 minute of really distilled insight into what we are confronting, these enemies, foreign and domestic. You can go to centerforsecuritypolicy.org and subscribe. It's free. You just get them first thing in the morning, and it will give you, I think, an appreciation of stuff you're not going to find anywhere else. And in this case, Pesek, what the Biden administration is going to do next in this global governance scheme of finding extra national, extra constitutional, and supranational means of coercing Israel into surrendering in Gaza, among many other terrible things, by the way, is to use the World Health Organization, whose director general they intend at the end of next month to put in charge of public health all over the world, including here in the United States. And I just want to tell you, this guy is no good. A, he brought us the China model for the pandemic, which killed, in, I think, the expert opinions of people like Dr. Malone and Dr. McCullough, 1 million Americans needlessly in the pandemic because they got his bad prescriptions instead of good medical advice from their own doctors. I just want to say, Pesek, this is coming down the tracks. Israel, like the rest of us, need to stand against this idea that the World Health Organization will become the arbiter of whether there's, for example, a public health emergency in Gaza, and whether, as Tedros Ghebreyesus, who's already called it a death zone, by the way, is going to be able, he certainly will be willing, whether he's going to be able to then demand that sanctions be imposed on Israel and anybody who helps her, unless and until she surrenders to Hamas. I've used up all the time for this block. We're going to take a pause, and you're going to get the turn at it next. Rabbi Pesek Wilicki is with us.
I have a lot to say about this.
Praise God. We're looking forward to hearing what he has to say. Stay tuned. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Amidst intensifying color revolutionary activity on college campuses mounted by the Red-Green Alliance of Communists and Sharia Supremacists, the Biden administration seeks new ways to coerce Israel to surrender to Hamas. Global governance is the newest technique. For example, Team Biden has reportedly greenlighted the International Criminal Court's impending indictment of Israeli leaders. In 4 weeks, moreover, Biden wants to subject the United States and Israel, among other nations, to two treaties that would allow Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the World Health Organization, to declare public health emergencies of international concern and dictate what must be done in response. Ghebreyesus considers Gaza to be a health emergency, and it is predictable that if he is given those dictatorial powers, he will use them to sanction Israel and probably any country that supports her. Join us in rejecting this ominous gambit at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back. Rabbi Pesach Wilicki is with us. He is the host of Shoulder to Shoulder, a wonderful podcast in Israel. He is the contributor to Israel 365 News. He is also the star and host of his own television program right here on the Real America's Voice Network. I'm very pleased to say Eyes on Israel is a tremendous addition to this lineup. Rabbi, I spent most of the time talking in the last block, and I want to give you a shot at telling us how you see things in terms of the Biden administration's conduct, as well as how Benjamin Netanyahu, your prime minister, is holding up under this coercive pressure.
Well, Frank, you mentioned the efforts of the Biden administration to remove Benjamin Netanyahu. You know, they have this fantasy that if they remove him, they could replace him with someone more amenable to their foreign policy goals, which really involve the weakening of Israel. They don't seek to destroy Israel, per se, but they don't want a strong Israel. They prefer a weak Israel that's very dependent. They prefer this delicate balance of power where the enemy states of Israel have a lot of leverage over Israel and that Israelis continually live under siege. That's what they prefer. And that's
what... Could I just disagree with you on that, sir? My sense is that at least some people in this administration...
Oh, sure.
Come with a pedigree of seeking the destruction of Israel.
Oh, that I agree with you.
But the other point is that whether the rest of them overtly and admittedly seek the destruction of Israel, their policies are going to conduce to it.
Make oh, for no sure. Mistake. And they cost Israeli lives, and Israelis die as a direct result of Biden administration policies. And I could catalog that for you, you know, all day long. And I think in some of our previous segments I have. But in terms of the efforts to remove Benjamin Netanyahu, we've talked about this, and you mentioned Caroline Glick before. She's been reporting on this a lot, that there is a color revolution underway. The Biden administration is in regular contact with the shrinking left in Israel, the shrinking but very influential left. They, like in America, your viewers should understand, they control the media, they control all the major institutions, and therefore they have an outsized public face, which makes people think that the people are in agreement with them. Now, they also control the top echelon of the military, especially the retired military, meaning this is changing. The military is becoming more in line with the nationalist right, but it's a slow process because people who hold right-wing or more faithful religious views tend not to get promoted. So that top echelon of the former military people, you know, these former generals who become talking heads in the media, are people you have to watch, because that's where the messaging from the left in Israel really comes from. And what we saw over the weekend, just over the last couple of days, Frank, in the Israeli papers in Hebrew, is that op-eds, opinion pieces, suddenly popped up simultaneously in all of the mainstream left-wing media outlets, all saying that an invasion of Rafah is actually not so necessary, and really there's other goals that we should be pursuing, and maybe normalized relations with Saudi Arabia are more important, and maybe we could rely on the international community, but basically making the case that Rafah is not essential. Now, that is not the opinion of the vast majority of Israelis, and it's also not the opinion of empirical reality. Hamas is genocidal terrorists who will grow their organization if they're given a foothold, if they remain there. They have to be rooted out completely. But here you see the messaging coming out of the left in Israel is designed to destabilize Netanyahu, because Benjamin Netanyahu has been adamant, including in today's headlines, talking about the upcoming potential agreement to free some hostages. He's saying very clearly, no matter how long we agree to in a ceasefire, an invasion of Rafah to destroy Hamas is absolutely a certainty. It is non-negotiable. There will be no end to this war until Hamas is completely destroyed. So you see here, you know, what's happening. Netanyahu is holding firm. He's also spoken out very strongly against what's going on in The Hague with the International Criminal Court. He has really not wavered, and thank God for that. I'm grateful for his leadership at this time. But
me too. But let me ask.
The administration is working with his enemies on a daily basis. We know that.
And I suspect one of those who is engineering all of this color revolution on behalf of the Biden administration is William Burns, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who has been in and out of these negotiations for a ceasefire and is clearly running as much as he can ops against the Israeli government to try to get them to capitulate. I do have to say, and I'm an admirer of Benjamin Netanyahu, who have been for a long time, warts and all, frankly, I am concerned that while he has not wavered on the rhetorical position, he is not pulling the trigger. And as I understand it, you may even have family members who are in this position. There are units ready to go, and they have been ready to go for some time. That's at the expense, in many cases, of doing their jobs and so on. This is what ultimately is the test of whether he's wavering or not, it seems to me, sir. Your thoughts?
Yeah, waiting for Rafah, or Rafiach, as we pronounce it here in Israel, waiting for Rafiach has become a theme. A lot of Israelis wondering, okay, when are we going in? When are we going in? At the same time, Frank, there was a pause, not quite as long a pause, but there was a pause in the action before we went into Khan Yunis after the first hostage deal was done. That also gave a lot of Israelis were very worried that we weren't going to be able to ramp it up and start again, and we did. And that has given some confidence. I agree with your concerns. I am very concerned about that, especially with the full court press that is coming from the Biden administration on this point. But at the same, so Israelis are a little bit on edge. When are we going to do it? When are we going to do it? At the same time, there's still a lot of cleanup going on. You know, in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, even though we've destroyed the organized battalions of Hamas, that anyone who knows anything about urban warfare knows that after you do that, there's then the next stage of urban warfare, which is the more guerrilla, chaotic warfare that we knew was coming. And we're still dealing with that all over the northern part of the Gaza Strip and, of course, in Khan Yunis. So from the Israelis' perspective, you got to remember, we're a citizen army. Everyone in Israel has family members and neighbors, and everyone's kind of plugged into what's going on militarily. So we have our, including me, sure, I have, like my son in that last troop pullout, one of my sons came out, my kids and my son-in-law, who's an officer, were all with us for Passover, and they were talking, and I was asking my son about his buddies who are also in the army. He has a friend in the tank corps who had been in Gaza all the way through since the beginning. I said, what's going on with him? He said, well, he's sitting on his base in the south waiting to go into Rafah. That's the theme. That's what's going on here. But so we have our hands full with that, but there is a sense of uneasiness of when are we going to do this. But there's also a sense of inevitability, that it is, if you told any of these people, you told my kids, you told my neighbors, that the decision was made that we're not going into Rafah, there would be an absolute uproar. No political party, no political leadership would survive. So the disconnect between the mainstream media in Israel, which is progressive left, the disconnect between them and the people is widening on this point.
I've got 1 minute left, and I want to hit 2 points quickly with you, sir. One is, we're insistently told people are starving in Gaza and there must be emergency infusions of aid. The other is, I want to talk to you about the latest Harvard-Harris poll here in the United States. Go.
All right, we don't have much time, but on the first point, the amount of trucks of humanitarian aid that have been brought into the Gaza Strip could feed everyone in the Gaza Strip four times over for the amount of time that these trucks have been coming in. Now, it could be that there are many people in the Gaza Strip who are not getting food because it's all being commandeered by Hamas and other things are being done with it. But it's certainly not the fault of Israel that the food's not getting there. The Gaza Strip is overflowing with humanitarian aid, and this is just an empirical fact. On the second point about the Harvard-Harris poll, what you're referring to is that a recent Harvard-Harris poll that was just released the other day that shows that 80% of Americans, 80%, a full 80% of Americans, and even a majority of young Americans who skew more anti-Israel, but still a majority of them, are backing Israel in this war and are not on the side of Hamas. So there again, just like in Israel, you have this gap between how the mainstream media portrays this war and where the people are at.
And it puts in sharp contrast both the Biden administration's conduct, which is betraying the state of Israel, and the so-called color revolutionaries on campuses that are dominating the news feed. We have to go. You will have a program very shortly this week to get your words in more fully than you have here. I apologize, my friend. Come back soon. We'll do it again.
And we'll have you on soon. God bless you. Israel. God bless.
Good. I look forward to it. We'll be right back, folks. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. And this is a very special personal privilege, I have to say, to welcome to this program once again a man we have not talked to in altogether too long. I'm very proud to say he is a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy. He is a medical practitioner, a medical doctor specializing in nuclear medicine. He is a retired lieutenant commander in the United States Navy, including a stint as one of the physicians on Capitol Hill, detailed there by the Navy. He is perhaps best known, however, for being a leading voice on behalf of what I believe are the majority, probably the vast majority, of Muslims in this country who came here or have grown up here, actually loving this country, not wanting to turn it into a Sharia state, not wanting to overthrow its constitution, but to continue to live side by side with non-Muslims in peace and with the shared freedoms that we all generally take too much for granted. His name is Dr. Zudi Jasser. I'm extremely proud to say that I not only always have great pleasure in welcoming to this program, but also just the greatest of personal affection for him, for all he has done for our country and that he is continuing to do. Just two other data points on him. He was a member of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, where he was, as he has often been, standing up for, I believe, Muslims who are not Sharia supremacists, a thorn in the side of those who are, including the Muslim Brotherhood and the Iranian mullahs and others. He is also, a candidate for Congress in the state of Arizona, from which he hails. It is terrific to have him with us and to have an extended opportunity to talk with him in the course of the remainder of this program. Dr. Zudi Jasser, welcome back to Securing America, my friend. It's good to have you with us.
It's always great to be with you, Frank. Thank you so much for having me back.
It's a pleasure. Let me start by just asking you. I was going through the archives of the Center for Security Policy. And by the way, folks, let me just say, one of the most important focuses of our work over decades has been in this space, the clash between Islam and Islamists, or between moderate Muslims like Zudi Jasser and the Sharia supremacists. You can find all of it at centerforsecuritypolicy.org, in book form, in videos, and much more. And I strongly encourage you to go there, centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Zudi, in those archives was an article that you wrote back in February of 2021, shortly after the Biden administration came to office. And you had some profoundly important insights into what had been engineered a few months before by a Muslim Brotherhood front group called M-Gage. Before we talk about that group, what it did, and the consequences of it, I do want to ask you to talk a little bit about the Muslim Brotherhood as you see it. You have sparred with these guys as long as I've known you. Usually you've gotten the better of them, but it's not been without a lot of scars that have been inflicted upon you. So give us your, unvarnished assessment of who these guys are. And for that matter, you know, the other Sharia supremacists who seek to represent themselves as the voice of Islam in America.
Yeah, thank you for that. And thank you for your leadership at the Center for Security Policy. I mean, you guys have been way ahead of the curve for now decades since 9/11, trying to educate America about a fight that many of us have been having within the House of Islam for generations, which is the political Islamists, the Islamist movement, which believe that ultimately national identity is based in an Islamic constitution where the Quran is the constitution, where clerics basically wield the legal system, which is Sharia supremacism, as you have aptly and correctly described it. And we saw in the Arab Awakening, as much as many of us had wanted to see the dictatorships displaced and freedom reign, ultimately the Islamists filled that vacuum. And we saw the Muslim Brotherhood come to power in Egypt through a majoritocracy and by becoming the only alternative, the only organized alternative. And the Islamist movements, we learned in America in the Holy Land Foundation trial that came to be in 2007 and 8 and then needed to be retried, and they were convicted. And I'll remind folks that in 2008, the board of the Holy Land Foundation trial was convicted for funneling money to Hamas. And that network of the Muslim Brotherhood, as explained in their explanatory memorandum, in 1991, they had a Philadelphia meeting in which they gathered the precursors to the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, the alphabet soup of Muslim Brotherhood legacy groups that came to the West, not to necessarily evangelize Islam, but to control Western policy so that they could be left alone. Just like Al-Qaeda's mission was to get America out of Saudi Arabia, etc. The Islamists want the West, want Israel destroyed, want the West no longer influencing the Muslim majority countries so that they can create a neo-caliphate. And we've seen in the UN, for example, the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which are Muslim majority countries, guide and work together with the far left, the red countries, China, Venezuela, and others, in the red-green axis. And ultimately, we saw with the explanatory memorandum that the Muslim Brotherhood, through its mosque network and through others, basically had a plan in which to co-opt the far left through minority identity politics and try to radicalize the left. And we were talking about this and how the West was radicalized. I wrote pieces during the Black Lives Matter movement about how it was led by the Farrakhans of the world. The most grotesque anti-Semitic movements were running the Black Lives Matter movement. And it was par for the course as far as the Islamists working with them through their network. They had invigorated post 9/11, gaslighting us about Islamophobia, exaggerating minority politics in order to drive the West, in order to drive Western policy to shrink away from Muslim majority countries and let the Qatars, Turkeys, Irans of the world dominate the Muslim world.
Right. I do want to just give our audience another look at this book. It's the explanatory memorandum Dr. Jasser's just been describing. It's very thin. It's available for free as a downloadable PDF at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Check it out. It couldn't be a more succinct treatment of the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood and its fellow Islamists, I think, inside the United States, including this famous quote, that their mission in North America is a kind of grand jihad whose purpose is destroying Western civilization from within by their hands, meaning the hands of non-Muslims, and the hands of believers, so that Allah's religion is made victorious over all other religions. That's pretty much a verbatim quote, Zudi. And again, you have been trying manfully with a relatively small, unfortunately, band of courageous Muslims like you to stand against all this, to call it out. I mean, your extraordinarily clear depiction just now of what these guys are about, who they are, how they've gotten organized, how they've insinuated themselves into our country. Well, it's not obviously something they would like having about. In particular, the point that you've made, and we have as well, that there is a collusion between, on the one hand, these Sharia supremacists, and on the other, the communists or Marxists of other stripes. What we're looking at, in short, I think, is a life and death struggle with these guys that must be regarded as such. And the first people who are subjected to it, I would argue, and invite your comment, are the Muslims who are not with that program, who are either being silenced or at least coerced into going along with what's afoot here. And I want you to talk a little bit specifically about all this in the context of Joe Biden's meeting in July of 2020, in the course of the campaign, with this group called M-Gage. Who are those folks and how do they relate to this MB infrastructure?
Yeah, so M-Gage is basically a political action group that is another form, the latest formulation in 2020 of the Islamist lobbyists, if you will, that try to impose basic identity politics about Muslim voting blocks within the Democratic Party. We saw that as...
And even the Republican Party for a time.
Yes, yes, and they still have some influence on identity politics, as many of the folks ignorant to the jihadist movement and what they're actually trying to do and how little values they share with conservatives and Americans in general, on skin-deep issues related to simply identity politics, they think they're a benign group, when in fact M-Gage basically held out an ultimatum to the Biden administration saying that, you know, if you do not toe the line as far as fealty to whether it's the Islamist movement out of Turkey, with Erdogan's movement, with Qatar, with the Khomeinists and the Muslim Brotherhood, if you don't basically toe the line of the Ilhan Omars and Rashida Tlaibs of the world, that ultimately we will vote against you. And we see that now happening in 24 with the uncontested, you know, those folks are not going to vote with Trump, but they're certainly going to, they're the Bernie Sanders Islamists, where they can decide an election by making sure Biden doesn't get elected. So they end up wagging the dog, if you will, as the
speaking of dog, I have to take a short break here. Mine is barking in the background, but Zudi Jasser is going to stay with us. We'll be right back with much more about these Sharia supremacists, their agenda for America, and what we better be doing to counter it. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Amidst intensifying color revolutionary activity on college campuses mounted by the Red-Green Alliance of Communists and Sharia Supremacists, the Biden administration seeks new ways to coerce Israel to surrender to Hamas. Global governance is the newest technique. For example, Team Biden has reportedly greenlighted the International Criminal Court's impending indictment of Israeli leaders. In 4 weeks, moreover, Biden wants to subject the United States and Israel, among other nations, to two treaties that would allow Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the World Health Organization, to declare public health emergencies of international concern and dictate what must be done in response. Ghebreyesus considers Gaza to be a health emergency, and it is predictable that if he is given those dictatorial powers, he will use them to sanction Israel and probably any country that supports her. Join us in rejecting this ominous gambit at sovereignticoalition.org. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are having a very special conversation, very timely one, with the author of A Battle for the Soul of Islam, an American Muslim patriot's fight to save his faith. I commend it to you strongly. His name is Dr. Zudi Jasser, among many other things, a medical doctor, but also a leader in the movement to have an American Muslim community that is not dominated by Sharia supremacists seeking the destruction of our country. And Dr. Jasser, again, I so appreciate your efforts in that regard. And I just wanted to have you further calibrate for us the penetration that was seemingly obtained by the Muslim Brotherhood and its friends when Joe Biden had a virtual meeting, as I recall, with leaders of M-Gage, and that would be the alphabet soup of the Muslim Brotherhood, as I recall too, and committed to appoint Muslims throughout his administration if he had their support. How's that worked out, sir?
Well, Hamas could not have been more pleased with the results. At the end of the day, you had State Department appointees that included Islamists that had fealty to the Muslim Brotherhood, fealty to Hamas, fealty to Iran. You had, as you recall, I wrote a piece for you back in 2022 about Ilhan Omar's desire to create a neo-caliphate at the State Department with a czar of Islamophobia, which thankfully was defeated. But they also then appointed an Islamist, Rima Dodin, I think was her name, to be the liaison with the legislature, with Congress from the White House. So then you look at the policies and you saw all of a sudden an attempt to try to release billions to Iran year, month after month, year after year, where the Abraham Accords were no longer even spoken of by name. And they were there was an attempt to dismantle them. And basically they functionally did. And you saw then all of a sudden, it wasn't a surprise that within a few years, Hamas was rearmed, was fueled because billions were released and allowed to sort of flow back as a result. And the maximum pressure campaign of Pompeo and Trump was no longer, it was minimum pressure. And the doctrine in the Middle East was no longer about helping those who support our values and share our values, but rather about don't. It was sort of this don't doctrine, which meant nothing. It was sort of, yeah, they did it. And they not only allowed Iran to arm Hamas, it's not a coincidence that before the end of the Biden administration, you saw the most horrific attack on the Jewish population, on Israel since the Holocaust. Pogroms across the border into Israel, where door to door over 1,400 Jews were genocidally killed. And you see now on campuses across the country, the Islamists fomenting with the far left a hate for Jews, a hate and anti-Semitism, a radicalization of the Democratic Party that was radicalized because of the people they put into place within the White House and in the State Department that we were fighting against in the U.S. Commission as I was trying to push back against the left and the Zoghbis that were on the commission with me and others that ignored what was actually happening. And now it's all come to fruition because our firewalls weren't strong enough, because nobody was paying attention to what we were trying to express was happening before our eyes during the early Biden administration.
Well, and I just want to go back to the early Biden administration, because as I said at the outset of this interview, in February of 2021, you warned of a Trojan horse that had been wheeled into the White House effectively, which had the veneer of moderation, but in fact had radicals of both. I think you were very, you know, prescient in warning about of this Islamist, or I call it Sharia supremacist stripe, but also the communists with whom they've been making common cause ever since. And you've mentioned a couple of names. We could go on in the Pentagon, as well as the National Security Council and various other liaisons with people who are pedigreed, you know, supporters of, associates with, veterans in some cases as well. Organizations like UNRWA that have been instruments for advancing the jihadism of Hamas, not countering it. And I guess I wanted to just ask you this, Zidi, as a man struggling for the soul of Islam, as a man struggling to represent an entire congressional district in the near future, perhaps, but certainly represent an American Muslim community for decades now, that is, I believe, and I think you do too, quite large, but mostly silent. And you understand better than most why that silence applies. It's terrifying and perhaps even endangering, as you know, to speak ill of the Brotherhood and the Islamists more generally. Can you comment a little bit about all of this in the context of what we're seeing playing out now on college campuses, Zudi? This red-green axis on the one hand and the pro-Hamas character of these so-called demonstrations?
Yeah, it breaks my heart to see what's happening across our campuses. But, you know, many of us were being canceled before it was cool to be canceled and before people were paying attention to what was happening. And as Andrew Breitbart said a decade ago, you know, politics is downstream of culture, and our culture has been radicalized. There are a lot of, you know, terrorism was normalized, and the Islamists started it, and then Black Lives Matter and the far extreme left began to normalize it. And now our country is bearing that fruit. And we see so much radicalization, which is one of the reasons I'm running, is that it's not just about the Islamists. That's the, you know, the Jewish community has been at the head of the spear. But after anti-Semitism comes anti-Americanism and anti-Israel and anti-Westernism. We have to save the West. And if we're going to save the West, we have to realize that the battle that I'm fighting against theocracy was the battle that rooted in the foundations of America against theocracy. And that ultimately, if we're going to separate mosque and state and defeat the institutions of radical Islam, we also have to recognize that the institutions of the Chinese Communist Party, the institutions of Qatar, of Turkey, of all of these institutions that are either autocratic, kleptocratic, or theocratic, are all going to target the West. And unless we band together with folks that share our values within our communities, our districts, our universities, our future students that now are holed up, you know, they're not talking about releasing hostages. They're not talking about condemning Hamas. They're actually glorifying genocidal acts of terror. And not one of them is mentioning releasing hostages, which is, I just get choked up thinking about it. It's horrific.
No, you're absolutely right. The only thing I would disagree about, you know, everything you just said is, it's not just that they are contemplating this as a plan, they're acting on it as we speak.
Yes.
We'll be right back with more with Zudi Jasser. Stay tuned. We're back. Dr. Zudi Jasser is in the house virtually, I'm pleased to say, calling in from Arizona, where he is, among other things, a medical practitioner, but also a champion of religious freedom and a proponent of an Islam that is not seeking Sharia supremacy or otherwise the overthrow of our government, for heaven's sakes. He is also now a candidate for the United States Congress, bringing these ideas and recommendations to the campaign trail. And we're very pleased to have him with us. Zudi, before we get to your campaign and what you're trying to accomplish with it, I did want to just ask you about one thing. You mentioned that terrorism is being normalized. And I think that's so true. I think maybe it's just a symptom of what's also being normalized more generally, which is this idea that has long been cultivated, not least by the communists on our college campuses, namely hatred for America, the belief that this country is evil and that its destruction is warranted, and by association, those we have as allies around the world similarly should be dispatched, including, of course, Israel. Your assessment of this is all the more interesting because I just had somebody say to me the other day that Yuri Bezmenov, who was a prominent Soviet defector and who did a series of videotaped interviews that I commend to everybody, they're really required viewing. Some, as I recall, 50 years ago, maybe now, 60, he declared that there were four stages to the communist takedown of the United States, the fourth of which was the phase he called normalization. And it was pointed out to me that we are in the fourth phase. I wonder if you might comment on that briefly, and then we'll turn to what you're trying to do about it, sir.
Yeah, there's no doubt that, we need an offense in the conservative movement. And if you look at Natan Sharansky's book, which impacted me, you're talking about Soviet, former Soviets, he said he knew that the Soviet empire would fall when Reagan declared them the evil empire. And that's what an offense is like at the White House when Reagan was calling them out. And ultimately, if you look at Nazi history, Goebbels said the bigger the lie, the more it becomes believable. And ultimately, this is the issue, is that the radical activist, as Ilhan Omar stands and chants about anti-Americanism a few weeks after she gave
espousing a speech. Espousing it, not just chanting about it.
Espousing it, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And a few weeks after she was actually espousing greater Somali imperialism into the Horn of Africa. So this is somebody who said she would use her place in Congress to advance those interests against the interests of her constituents. This is what's happening, is that America is on the defense and we should be on the offense. We should be calling out the militants and defending. And Israel is the America of the Middle East. And this is why I'm so staunchly pro-Israel, is that it represents what the Middle East can be if the dictators are defeated, if Islamism is, and theocracy is defeated. And that's why we have to stand by them, because the future of the Middle East will go the way Israel does. If we defend them and stand by them, the future will be bright. If they suffer, if we don't stand by them against Iran and the threats, the existential and real threats that they have, then the West will wither within the next generation.
I couldn't agree with you more, Zudi, and I think that was brilliantly said. And congratulations on it, because I'm sure that's not universally felt, even among a lot of Muslims. And I hope that you're able to speak for all of us in making those kinds of points. Talk a little bit about, we don't do political endorsements on this program, of course, but talk a little bit about how you see your candidacy as it relates to, among other things, the public policy fights that we have as a result of the penetration of the Biden administration and its policies and the representation in Congress of Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and I guess others that are associated with them in the squad and that so on, that is giving quite a bit of prominence to the views that are antithetical to yours.
Yeah, you know, I think if you look, my family and I decided that it was time to run for Congress because we've seen the weaponization of government against, religious groups with post 9/11 counterterrorism, as you mentioned, there was lack of focus on that, and then the pandemic. Healthcare was weaponized against small businesses, against families, against others making healthcare decisions. And it's time, I think, as a conservative, we've seen the conservative movement playing defense. We need to play offense. We are the party of diversity. We are the party of individualism. And yet the collectivists, the extremists on the left have said, no, they're the party of minority. And I think I'm able to then say democracy. I'm able to then, as a conservative, as a son of immigrants who came legally and sought asylum here, put away all of that and get away with saying the same truths that so many of my colleagues like you and others say, and yet not be criticized because they can't. So many times I've gone to campuses and said so many similar things to what the anti-jihad movement has said, to what so many in the conservative movement have said in defense of Christian and Jewish rights, and they've been unable to then criticize me afterwards because I check the boxes of minorities, of minority immigrants, if you will. I'm pro-immigration, but pro-legal immigration, not about the hemorrhaging borders and the crimes and the drugs that's coming in, the economy that's destroying us and the Biden administration that's destroyed this country and how suicidal their policies have been. And it's time to change that and lead with offense. And I built coalitions from the Muslim Reform Movement to the Clarity Coalition against Islamist movements globally. We've had success in building that, and I'd like to take that to Congress.
Yeah, well, I wish you all the best, my friend, not least because you are not an Islamophobe, which is the standard retort to many of those of us, wrongly, who have been making similar points to your own. Godspeed, Zudi Jasser. Thank you for this extended visit. I so appreciate your clarity on so many of these issues, which desperately require such clarity as well as such courage. We'll look forward to further updates with you in the near future. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you about the work we do at the Center for Security Policy. I hope you'll check it out at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. And while you're there, please hit that donate button. Make this show possible. Godspeed. We'll talk with you too on the next occasion. Till then, go forth and multiply.